What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Hapness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Lorenz Zell, and we speak about the L word, love, and learning, and how to create a platform to enable both. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And now, enjoy. And you mentioned a few times about what it is that you're doing today, so creating these learning spaces. So what is it that you do today? Tell us.
Yeah, so it's very much related to what we've been talking about. You know, so I mentioned this mystical experience I had 11 years ago and really this inquiry into being in service of peace, into, you know, what does it mean to create world peace? And, you know, the last 11 years has been like this really intense journey, inquiry into that question, a lot of trial and error, just really trying to understand, you know, what does that mean? And what's emerged through that, I guess my radically simplified worldview. Radically simplified, I want to really give myself, create a container around that, is that when you have interaction at sufficiently deep levels of awareness, peace is inevitable. And so what that means is, or really the question that leaves me with is really around cultivating this capacity of awareness, of you know, presence with what's there for you, or what's there for another person, what's there in a space, a capacity for deep listening, a capacity for feeling a person. You know, this is a very sophisticated capacity in a way, like feeling yourself and another person and the space in between at the same time, really being present to all of that. It's a very, you know, like sophisticated human capacity, and then having the capacity to hold space for what's there, like a willingness and a courage to be with what's in that space constructively, you know, because things come up, you know, between people, mm-hmm. like even the most talented, people who've been doing inner work for years and years and years, you know, plenty of disagreements. It happens all the time. And there can be, you know, blow-ups and but yet a capacity to be with things that come up and a skillful, you know, and the skillfulness to navigate that in a way that creates coherence, you know, in a way that creates connection, even when there's something that maybe like seem like a catalyst for disconnection, that if we can hold space for that and navigate it can actually create connection, deeper understanding, deeper compassion for the human experience. So these are all capacities that you learn through direct experience. You these are practice. These are like lifelong practices. And so that's really become the impetus for the work that we do, is creating spaces where people have an opportunity to practice new ways of being together. And so about 7 years ago in 2015, you know, we'd been spending like 4 or 5 years doing a lot of trial and error on, you know, how do you create real deep human connection online? Mostly like a lot of error. And so I participated in the ULAB program out of the Presencing Institute, which is an organization out of MIT. And they had 30,000 people in the program. And they broke us up into groups of 5 people. And it was one of the first times where I connected with strangers online and felt a very deep level of connection. And so it really kind of catalyzed this idea that the way that people feel connected is through small groups. And so I started, I came out of that. And like I said, we'd already been doing a lot of trial and error for like 4 or 5 years. And so I went to my wife and I was like, you know, there's something here around small groups and connection. And I want to create some software around that. And so I wrote the first line of code for Sutra in 2015. And then about a year and a half later, and we just started, you know, like 3 months later, we were like, we tested it in a co-working space. We were trying in different community projects. We brought into, you know, we also been going to Burning Man for a long time. And that's been a big inspiration for this work. And we use it to organize a Burning Man camp. And then we had an opportunity to work with the Harvard program in refugee trauma. which they have a 7-month blended learning program, and they were looking to update their learning platform. And Natasha, my wife, had helped start that program 10 years earlier. And so we kind of convinced them to give Sutra a try. And it, you know, and we had like really high levels of engagement. And so it really catalyzed the second idea that the learning together can be a catalyst for participation. And so these two kind of, I think the two big epiphanies that came out of this process were that the way the connection happens is through small groups, and that learning can be a catalyst for connection. And so that's really been the journey of the last 7 years, is really looking at this intersection of group learning, connection, deeper levels of awareness and presence, this understanding that, you know, this thing that we call love is about direct experience. It's about developing capacities, you know, new ways of being together that involve listening, presence, sensing. And so what we do now is we've built a platform that's really designed around group learning, around the kind of like the theory and the philosophy that I've just shared. And we also realized that, you know, we always say Sutra by itself doesn't magically create meaningful connection. Like a tech platform by itself doesn't magically create meaningful connection. The big part of that is the process. It's how you architect the space. It's how you invite people into that experience. So many of our experiences are a combination of Zoom and kind of how that space is constructed to invite deeper levels of sharing and trust and commitment and participation. And then how that can be woven into an online space where there's an opportunity to really deepen that discussion. And how do you, you know, create a container for that overall experience? So that's, so what we do today is basically Sutra, which is a tech platform that allows you to easily organize content and discussion spaces with a lot of kind of support and best practices around how to connect that with face-to-face Zoom experiences that really emphasize connection and presence.
Lots to unpack.
There was a lot there. Yeah, I think.
Good. And I just have to decide very quickly which kind of chain of thought to follow. One thought was almost, is learning the excuse to build connection, or is the connection the excuse to learn?
I guess it depends on what you mean by learning, right? Like, because there's very different, I think it's also critical to understand the spectrum of learning. Because on one side, go ahead.
It's funny because this would have been the other question. So let me just throw it in, okay. And then you can answer them together. What kind of learning you're focusing on with Sutra? Because you mentioned a Harvard program, blended learning program. So I immediately think of educational learning in the educational kind of sphere. Mm-hmm. And maybe there are more layers to that. Check.
Yeah. So I think that's a great question. Like, first, just talking about online learning, right? There's a broad spectrum there of, on the one hand, you have what's like called an evergreen course. Like you put content together, you put it up on a website, people somehow sign up or purchase it, and then they go through it on their own. And I kind of think of that as like a digital book. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have a group experience where there's an emphasis on connection. And so you're not just optimizing for content, you're also optimizing for connection. And that's a very different kind of experience. It involves a different level of involvement on the part of the course creator, very different kind of skill set, very different intention, very different commitment in a way. And so we're talking about those kinds of experiences and really this idea that it can be about anything. It doesn't have to be about mindfulness or meditation. You know, you can have this kind of conversation-based, connection-based learning experience around almost any subject matter. And then as far as, you know, like academic programs or, you know, a lot of our users tend to be coaches, consultants. I think the key thing is just people who, I mean, there's a couple of things here. Is one, I think people are completely overwhelmed by content. We live in this like super information heavy world where, you know, there's a 24-hour news cycle. There's like a billion online courses. And I think people are starved for like connection. There's only so much you can also absorb and learn. And this is also one of the biggest things that people, we have a program called Transformational Teaching Online. And I think one of the biggest things we hear people pass through the program, and they're like, I want to completely reframe and redesign what I want to do, because they realize that it's not about creating 1,000 modules with all this content. It's really about creating an experience where people have an experience And I would add to that where people actually learn something that they take away, you know, that they actually like, that stays with them. And that there's a richness there and a connection. And that's what we're talking about. How do you create that?
And what I hear is a disruption, maybe, or an upgrade of these online courses. I have the impression that over the past 5 years, almost every coach, facilitator created their own online course. And I think everyone who has tried it is very aware of, or I think everyone who listens to the podcast has at least dropped out or purchased an online course and never visited the material because of exactly what you're saying, right? And what I hear from you is the interconnections are how to make it easier for those who actually want to learn online, to make it easier because there's not only the content, but we are learning through the connection and the exchange. And we are also learning through the interaction with the content in a live in a live and small group context. So I'm curious, what is the level of facilitation know-how or experiential learning know-how that is needed to design such a course on your platform? Or to what extent is the platform actually the facilitator of this kind of program that it's weaved into it and to make it easy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we'd like to develop the platform to become a facilitator in a way, in the way that you're describing. I think that's a really great idea. You know, one of our mantras is, really revolves around prototyping and really this idea that if you're creating what we call a relational experience, so an experience where there's an emphasis on the quality of awareness and connection and ultimately relationship, that's a living process. It's going to be different in every context. It's going to be different with every, you know, community, body of knowledge. And that a big part of it is just starting with a prototype, you know, kind of creating an outline of it, setting an intention that it's not just about the content, that it's about the connection and the conversation, and then bringing together 5 or 10 people into, you know, maybe a simplified version of that. It could be as simple as a 2-hour workshop. It could be like a 4-week experience or something like that. And that you iterate into that to kind of discover what it wants to be, to allow it to emerge through a process of really engaging with the real world. And, you know, in that sense, I think that really reduces the bar for the skill set that you need as a facilitator. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's a big part of this thing is that if you have a genuine desire to create connection, if you have a genuine desire to kind of share what you know in a way that creates connection conversation, I mean, it's likely that you already have like some sort of deep relationship with the material. You understand this. It's in you in a way. And the other side of it is that, you know, the biggest thing we see with people who are like really in their head, they have this big vision and all these ideas. And unfortunately, more often than not, those are the people that I often see fail because their vision is so big and it's so kind of disconnected from reality that when they actually try to bring it into reality at that scale, there's no engagement. And it kind of like, it has momentum as long as it's not real. And I say this like it's almost funny, but it also really breaks my heart because the truth is, you know, and I feel like it's almost reflected in my journey too, in a way. It's like world peace, you know, right? And then really like, I mean, it's 10 years of really kind of like intense and many times brutal trial and error to bring that down to, you know, group learning experiences that invite presence and meaningful connections. Very like, you know, it has a very different energy to it. And so, you know, this whole idea is that when you want to bring something into the world, it has to be based on the reality of people, of how they show up, what makes them engage, what is actually interesting to them, like what they're willing to actually participate in, because these are participatory experiences. It's not, that's another difference with like a content experience, like where you're just putting content on a website. Content's on the website, someone buys it. It, you know, your job is done. You know, it's not, I mean, if you're a really good human, you're going to care about if they complete it or not and think about that. But in reality, and then they may or not complete it. But if you're running this kind of experience, participation is everything. Mm-hmm. And that's based on reality. And so what is the reality of the people that you're working with, the body of content that you're working with, the context that's there? And how do you work with that to create an experience? And for us, the answer to that is prototyping. Keep it simple, mm-hmm. bring a real group of people together and lean into it.
Maybe a weird question, but I ask it anyway because I'm curious. From what you shared and what I understand from your vision of what this platform is and can do, it puts the bar quite high. And at the end of the day, the platform can only deliver as well, as good as the person who is engaging with it. So how do you deal with maybe the responsibility? Two questions. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced it for someone to go totally wrong? Because you have to also, you need a basic skill set in order to have this participatory learning mm-hmm. and prototyping mindset. And if someone comes onto the platform and creates an unpleasant experience for the learners who trusted them, who trusted the platform, how do you deal with detaching yourself from this? And maybe also the reputation of the platform for someone who's using it in the air quotes wrong sense or even abusing it.
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest boogeyman in the online space is a disengagement that you create an online space, an online community, an online course, and there's just no conversation, no discussion. I'd say, I want to take a step back. There's two big boogeymen. One is the sales and marketing piece, is you put together your course and how do you actually sell it and build an audience. And then two is, especially if you're running this kind of group experience, is engagement and participation. And I think, to create an experience that really invites engagement is it's challenging. I mean, both of those aspects, really selling something is challenging, and then really creating that space is challenging. It's a learning process. And I think it takes a commitment. In a way, it's very much also an internal journey. I think that creating something successful online takes a lot of effort. I think there's a lot of course creation platforms out there that try to give you examples of all these people making six figures. Like, you can do this too. But the reality is, if you want to make six figures selling online courses, I'd say, except for the very, very, like very, very select few, it's an incredible hustle, like in a good way, it's effort, it's hustle. You're constantly like learning, iterating, prototyping, trying. And it's very much an internal developmental journey, of really understanding what you're good at, how you can find the resources you need, developing your capacity to be more resourceful. And so that's both on the outward kind of marketing side of it. And then of course the inward, like how do you create an engaged course or community space? So I guess for us on Sutra, like we haven't had this experience of like an unpleasant experience where we want to distance ourselves. I mean, for the most part, people create a space on Sutra and it's their space. It doesn't necessarily even have to be associated with Sutra so much. It's their brand. It's their space. It's almost like if you create the way Sutra is, it's almost like a combination of Slack and Notion. You have content pages, you have discussion spaces, you can brand it. And so when someone comes in, they're coming into your ecosystem. It's less that it's somehow strongly associated with Sutra. But for us, it's really important that people feel supported in creating these experiences where there is this quality of connection and presence and authenticity. And so we try to offer a lot of support for that. We have our course, we have office hours, and we're constantly, I think what you're pointing at is that the capacity to create this kind of experience isn't necessarily a natural skill set, particularly online, that there is a learning curve, that there is a lot of aspects to learn about. And so that's been a big discovery for us as well, that this thing that we're trying to create, this ecosystem of relational learning spaces, is also a developmental process for the people holding those spaces. And how do we support people in that journey?
Mm. Thank you. Very curious. What makes a workshop fail?
I think what comes to mind is when the container is not properly created. When something comes up in the space that the container that's been created for that experience isn't designed to support in a way. We had an experience just a few months ago. We ran a 5-day event series called Facilitate the Future. And one of the sessions was on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And Natasha and I weren't involved in really planning it, but so there was a couple of other facilitators that we worked with that were holding the space, but something came up in that space in the discussion. And this is another interesting nuance of holding space online on a Zoom, is that and I've seen this happen with the most skilled facilitators. I was on a course with Thomas Hubel a few months ago, and the chat just exploded, and you know, 1,000 people and a chat that's out of control, like you can't do much about it. And so we had a similar experience in this diversity, equity, inclusion session where something was touched, a race-related subject, which is one of the, you know, an area that can be very, very sensitive. And the chat just exploded. And the container hadn't. I think this is also an area where I'm learning more to include in the container, not just the visual space, but the discussion space. It's very easy to kind of like overlook the agreements that you create, or how you, especially in a sensitive space, of you know, being very clear about kind of the nature of the chat space, and then also having a lot of clarity on how to respond if that starts getting out of control. Because the challenge with the chat space is that there's no face-to-face, so there's no consequence. Right? Mm-hmm. I can just put something there and that triggers everyone else, and then everyone starts jumping in. There's no consequences, no relational concept. I think honestly, if you this is the challenge with media, you know, media in the world, is it's easy to say things and there's no relational consequence. You don't feel the impact. You don't get that kind of visceral face-to-face response. And so I think one of the things that can make a workshop fail is really, particularly more sensitive workshops. I'd say the more sensitive the workshop, the more absolutely critical it is to understand the container that you're creating and how to navigate that, how to respond if things go sideways.
Yeah, the image that came to my mind was immediately Twitter, where you rarely see this level of negative interaction on platforms like LinkedIn, for instance, because there's always a more of an identity or an image attached. So what would you do differently in a similar situation? So a part of the framing of the content and how you approach the topic, but from how would you set the container or the rules or behavioral agreements differently? Or would you maybe just close the chat?
I wouldn't close the chat. I think the chat is a big key part. So I mean, there's a couple of things I'll add here. And this goes back to maybe what I was sharing where we started the conversation about appropriateness. I think a big part of becoming a better facilitator is having these experiences where, you know, something goes wrong, and then becoming more sensitive to what can go wrong. In this case, what triggered the whole situation was a poem that was shared by one of the facilitators. And the poem had a line in there that you could say kind of stereotyped white people as being like dominant and oppressive. And so that triggered, you know, one of the white people in the audience in the chat. And when she shared that, that triggered a whole bunch of people that piled on her, you know, as a consequence of that. And so one of my insights from that, and if I had previewed that poem beforehand, I wouldn't have flagged that line. I would have noticed that. The key thing was it was a session on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think in retrospect, starting a session with a poem that kind of implicitly stereotyped white people in a particular way, I can see that. And, you know, and so now that's, I would notice that now, you know, and be very sensitive of if we're creating. And plus the session wasn't explicitly about race. It was a diversity, equity, inclusion, but it wasn't specifically about race. And so that person was like, I didn't know this was going to be about a session about race and white people. And, you know, so it was very inflammatory. So one of the learnings from that for me was to really notice the details. If you're dealing with something that is as hugely sensitive as race, it takes a tiny spark that can turn into a forest fire, and every little detail matters. The other thing around that is that I think that you know, one of my mantras is the space is the teacher in a way. And I really like to work with this idea of surfacing what's unspoken, but communicated anyway. And so in this case, this is obviously already being spoken, but it's something that's in the space. And so when you're running a session and the chat is blowing up, I think it's really important to maybe divert the session to deal with what's in the chat, to then, because it's also easy to kind of, you know, either shut down the chat or just continue running the session as if nothing's happening. But the reality, something is happening. You know, there's something that's in the space. And I think this is another area where, you know, it takes practice and skillfulness, and it's easy to think about in retrospect, but then in the moment, what do you do? But my inclination would be to really include what's happening and to move that discussion to kind of let go of the script, the structure, the plan, to move what's happening into the forefront and to invite, you know, some of the most active participants in the discussion in the chat space into the video space. So then it creates an opportunity for people to really witness, to really be with what's present for another person. Because that's where it all comes down to, is just what's the reality of a person's experience without judgment, you know, without morality. Can you just be with this person's experience, even if it disagrees with everything you believe in? Can you hold space for that because it's true for them? And I think that's where the rubber meets the road. That's the heart of it, is of like, you know, like love, is being with another person in this way.
Thank you for sharing this. I'm sure that the audience are taking as many kind of insights from this example, which can, yeah, surely happen to all of us. And it reminds me to what you said earlier about what are the moments that trigger us and that make us intolerant is when we are not seen as the person we want to be. Mm-hmm. Or they're not seeing something in us that for us is so clearly present. And then, as you say, giving them the opportunity in this moment to be seen and heard without judgment. That's then the high art of facilitation.
Mm-hmm. And felt, I think I would add to that, you know, seen and heard. And I'll add this as a tiny thing, you know, one of my triggers, and I think this is one of the challenges I feel with, yeah, this is such a nuance for me with facilitation. You know, one of the techniques I see with facilitators sometimes is to kind of somehow repeat back to you a version of what you heard. Mm-hmm. And as an expression of like, you know, that I hear you and I see you, but it doesn't mean I feel you. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference. And I always feel when someone is hearing me, but not feeling me.
Oh, that's a deep one. And it reminds me of a study that I read. I think I mentioned it a couple of times already on the show, but I will still repeat it, is that it was a bunch of psychologists, and they were asking how sympathetic someone at the McDonald's drive-thru would be to them. And the staff members of the drive-thru, they would either just repeat the order in the words that the client has been using, or would just be as friendly and nice, but saying different words and rephrasing the order. And clients would find the employee of the drive-thru the more sympathetic and would like them more, the more they just used the exact same wording as they did before. So I think in what I hear from your story, it's a sort of NLP. Oh, we have learned that people will like us if we're just repeating what they said. But then we are not at the McDonald's drive-thru. We're hosting a workshop, right? So it's not about being liked. It's about, yeah, feeling this compassion and bringing them to a deeper level. And to witness someone doesn't just mean to hearing the words and repeating them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the word that you just used is key, is to witness someone. You know, I don't know how to put this exactly, but I think there's an energetic transfer that happens there. You know, it allows, when there's something there for me, it allows that energy to somehow be diffused, to be received, to be channeled. And that's more than just feeling heard. That's feeling felt, that's feeling witnessed.
Yeah. And before we hit the record button, I was sharing my latest never done before experiment. And it was exactly about that, where someone would share something deeply, deeply personal and vulnerable while being on mute. And what I realized was how nourishing it is to witness someone in their deepest feelings and emotions, and that then we don't even need to hear the words. And I wonder whether this could even be used for such moments. So maybe this anger of the person, it's not about the words that will trigger someone else, but just to have the opportunity to express ourselves and to be witnessed with our emotions.
And now that you frame it like that, because when you first shared that with me, I shared with you that, you know, I couldn't quite feel the nuances of it. But now that you framed it like that, like I totally feel it. Yeah, that you may not be able to hear them, but you can feel them, you know, if you choose to kind of tune in that way. And I think that can be really powerful, is to really feel witnessed while you're sharing, even if the words aren't being heard.
Yeah. And the words maybe at the end don't matter for the others as much as they do for you. Because I think that's the driver of most conflict, is that we hear something different than what is actually said. Because we are making sense out of it and we only hear what we want to hear anyway. Well, that went too
deep,
easy.
Deep territory. Deep territory.
And then taking away this kind of this level, and just bringing it back to what actually counts is to the emotions, and that it's okay.
I think this, you know, I mean, we're getting into super deep territory here, but for me, all of this really lands in this territory of presence, you know, becoming present to another person, becoming present to your triggers, to your insecurities, you know, developing the capacity to hold space for that. You know, when someone else is sharing and there's a difference between what they're saying and how you're hearing it. And of course, it's, you know, causing something in you. And that's the reality, is it's, you know, it's causing something in you. And can you become present to that? And can you develop a capacity to really hold that and to really hear, be with, feel the other person? And if those conditions are met, then peace is inevitable, right? That's where I go back to what I said, my radically simplified worldview. Then peace is inevitable. But that's a really high functioning, you know, that's a really tall bar.
Especially, and I will bring up, and I will throw another deep topic into the conversation, which is neutrality. So is it possible to relate to someone and their experience of reality with all the emotions, connecting, witnessing, holding the space while being neutral?
I don't wonder if you need to be neutral, because it depends on your definition of neutral, because things might come up for me and then can I hold space for that? So I'm not necessarily neutral, right? But I am aware of, and I'm choosing, my wife and I have this conversation because she's like, how can I hold space for you when things come up for me when you're sharing? And I say, well, you hold space for that as well. And, you know, and I think this is such a big part of really hearing another person, is that, like, when you're speaking, if we're having a disagreement, if you're speaking and then things come up for me while you're speaking, if I'm then reacting to you from what I share, then you're never going to feel heard. So at some point I have to hold space for what's coming up for me. And that doesn't mean that there's a subtlety here, because it's easy to maybe make the assumption that if I am not reacting for what's coming up for me, then I'm kind of pushing what's there for me to the side and diminishing myself. But that's not at all the case. It's holding space for all of that. And first and foremost, like, if you're speaking, if you're sharing, then I honor you with that deep presence and capacity to hold space. And then it comes back to this appropriateness of how do you respond and all of that. But then, of course, if you feel entirely heard, there's a much higher probability that now, if there's an invitation for me to speak, that maybe you will offer me the same in return and hear me. And now we have the ground for a much more constructive interaction.
Yeah. And to hold back on the urge to respond immediately, to follow our own, you know, what's coming up for us.
Right.
It's like this mosquito bite, that it feels so good to scratch, although we know it's so bad because we only make it worse. But to sit with the itch, say, it shall pass, it shall pass. And then it will be better. I think it's, I have the impression that it's a similar experience when we feel the urge to reply, response. And thereby, yeah, not hold space for ourselves. I like the image or the picture that this evokes for me.
Holding space for yourself.
Holding space for yourself while the other person is sharing. And this gives a totally different connotation to the word of space. Because yes, for a while you are pushing something to the side. Maybe not pushing, but you're parking something. So another dimension of the space.
And that's the thing, is this is it's so rich because it really, it lands right in the middle of what does it mean to be human? You know, what does it mean to be human? And that's kind of goes back to where we started around, like, you know, being a facilitator or these functions, you know, of witnessing, listening, being, and holding space that are so deeply embedded in our core humanity, you know, to really be with another person, to really be with ourselves. And then, of course, the reality that there isn't any clear answer there, that it's an infinite inquiry and discovery, you know, and journey into all of that. It's very rich.
And although you have, we're running towards the, been talking for 1.5 hours, you have implicitly mentioned it, and I still want to ask the explicit question because I just enjoy hearing the answers of the different guests so much. What is your number one facilitation challenge?
You know, this is something I think about quite often. So it depends on the context. You know, if I'm facilitating with an entirely new group of people, if I'm facilitating with, you know, a group of people I've been with for a long time. But what I notice in Link Space for a new group of people, like when we're running one of our like free workshops, so you have, you know, strangers coming in from all over the world, I feel very early on, even sometimes before the call, kind of the coherence of that space before I enter it. And there's a really interesting intersection of my internal condition and then the people that are showing up and what's present in that collective space. And I think one of my biggest challenges as a facilitator is navigating that journey to coherence. You know, like sometimes you have a group of people together and there's just you, the forces with you. There's the flow, the right things are being shared. Like people are super active, everyone's talking. You're like, this is amazing, right? And sometimes it's crickets or there's just awkwardness and it's weird or someone is, people start talking for really long times about inappropriate things. And you're like, how do I deal with this? You know? And I think that, like, and then sometimes I'm in a really good place and sometimes I'm not. That's just the reality. I'm not like always like a, you know, perfect facilitation space when I have to facilitate, right? Sometimes I'm like, this is the last thing I want to do, but I do a lot of this. So inevitably I end up in situations where I have to show up. And I think that territory, because it also weaves in questions of authenticity and appropriateness. If I'm holding a space and I'm inviting everyone else to be authentic, you know, what does that mean for me? What's appropriate? Because a lot of my energy kind of sets the space for the other people there. And so, you know, my practice of kind of grounding and preparation before holding space, that I have a kind of a short physical practice and just really kind of getting settled. And then just navigating the, what I'm calling coherence here, you know, of a space from, I really feel like it's a relationship between what's present for me, what's present in the space, what I'm picking up, what's kind of coming up for me as a function of what's in the space, and then just my capacity to kind of ride that and have a certain skillfulness and also trusting the space. That's a big part of just like, I'm going to trust that I have this intention. Because for me, the intention is always that by the end, there'll be a very deep sense of connection and coherence. And so I, part of it is also just trusting that as long as that is my intention and I navigate that space with as much grace and skillfulness as I can, inevitably, sometimes it happens in at 1 hour and 59 minutes, But it almost always happens. And yeah, it's such a learning journey for me.
Thank you for sharing that. It's my favorite question.
It's a great question.
I only started to ask it recently, maybe 5 episodes ago. And it brings up so many learnings and this humility for our practice that it continues to be challenging at times.
All for me, all the time. I mean, I find the journey of holding space very challenging.
Yeah, for them and for us. Mm-hmm. And letting go of expectations of how it's supposed to be, how deep connection must look like. Mm-hmm. Because this is also something very personal, right? It's like love. To what extent someone feels connected to the space and the participants and the content is something that is out of our control.
And it's so rich, you know, because it's going to look different every time. And having the receptivity, the humility, you know, it's just, I really feel like it's, if you let it, it's a very deep personal transformation, you know, transformational journey for the space holder.
Yeah. And we'll put the link to experience that in the show notes so that the audience can test it out. As we're approaching the end of our time together, is there anything you would have liked to share or speak about that we haven't touched upon yet?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yes. So our 10-year journey with this work is really culminating in a big next step for us, which is we're running a crowdfunding campaign. So far, Sutra has really been an incredible labor of love and incredibly self-funded. And, you know, we're really coming to a place that in order to continue growing the platform, and really the heart of our platform is the creators, you know, and creating a community of, you know, people committed to working with people in this way, people committed to this kind of holding space and creating a platform that's really about providing them with the tools and technology to help them do what they do, and also opportunities for them to connect, to share knowledge and resources, to collaborate. So the next big journey for us is we're launching a crowdfunding campaign at the end of July.
2022?
Yes, 2022. July, tentatively, if the internet gods are with us, we're launching on July 25th, 2022, to raise $100,000 for Sutra. So, you know, if this speaks to you, talking to the audience, you know, I invite you to check it out. Check out Sutra. And also a part of what we'll be offering in that crowdfunder will be lifetime access to the platform. So for a hugely discounted rate. So if this speaks to you, you know, if the platform resonates with you, and also if you kind of resonate with being part of a community of people that kind of have a very similar relationship to love and presence as we've been talking about, then I hope you join us.
Thank you. I'll add all the information to the show notes.
Thank you, Miriam. It's been really wonderful to kind of take this deep dive into topics that are very, very close to my heart.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing and for going there. Who would have thought that we spend most of the time of the conversation speaking about love? Love and learning.
Love and learning. And I think the whole thing is that love is learning. You know, love is a process of learning, never ending.
What is there else to say? Amen.
The L word. Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for staying tuned and for listening to the show. I know how busy you are, and I appreciate that you're sharing your two most valuable resources with me and my guest, your time and your attention. If you're looking for more conversation with other facilitators and for a community of practice, why don't you join Never Done Before, the community that I have built and many of my podcast guests are already members. Visit neverdonebefore.org, and I wish to see you there.